Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. You know, we see so many cooking competitions these days. TV chefs try to beat Bobby Flay or battle each other in Kitchen Stadium or in the Chopped Kitchen. Local chefs compete for bragging rights for the best mac and cheese or tacos or tenderloins. So it's no surprise that home cooks want to compete too. And if you've always wanted to see how your specialty stacks up against others, then think about entering an Indiana State Fair food competition. There are categories for cupcakes, cinnamon rolls, yeast rolls, candy, all sorts of cookies, pies, cakes, even cake balls, plus dips, salsas, canned goods, pickles. There's even a hummus category. So really think about entering, and you can find out more information at IndianaStateFair.com. And this week here on Eat Drink Indie Radio, we're revisiting some interviews from last year's Indiana State Fair's Family Heirloom Recipe Contest that's sponsored by the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance. It's one of my favorite competitions to judge, so I hope you'll consider entering. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I love family recipes. I have boxes of recipes from my mom, recipes that she actually made, as well as lots and lots of recipes that must have been copied down or clipped out just because they sounded good. There are recipes for exotic dishes that we would never have had when I was growing up, as well as recipes jotted on napkins or backs of envelopes, written down while visiting friends or relatives, and lots of recipes clipped out of newspapers or from the backs of packages. Some of those turned out to be recipes that I remember the most, including a favorite sugar cookie recipe from the side of an Arm & Hammer baking soda box. Others, like a biscuit recipe or one for dumplings, came from my mom's home ec class. And they have held up great since the 50s. The biscuit recipe certainly got plenty of use when I was growing up. Biscuits and gravy has always been a family favorite. And it became a favorite in my own kitchen as well. And it's funny, but I don't recall many special recipes that we had around the holidays. Except for maybe stat cake. That's not a recipe that you see very often, and it's no surprise really, because it honestly doesn't yield a very pretty cake. Stat cake is simply a heavy spiced cake whose layers are thinly sliced, then put back together with layers of cooked dried apples. And then the outside of the cake is covered with more of the dark brown cinnamon cooked apples, so the result isn't really very pretty, but it tastes like the holidays to me. Like Thanksgiving or Christmas in my mom's kitchen. And that must be what it was like for the winner of this year's heirloom recipe contest at the Indiana State Fair. A homey recipe for date pudding won the contest, and it was a recipe that winner Ray Graham recalled having at every Christmas dinner. I'm not sure I can think of a recipe that my family has at every holiday dinner. Oh, there's always pumpkin pie at Thanksgiving, and usually apple, and always cranberry sauce, of course. But I don't think that I have a favorite recipe that has been passed down through generations. But maybe I can find one. Maybe I'll look through those boxes of recipes, and I'll find one from my grandmother or an aunt, and I'll make it a new family favorite. I have a few in mind. I'm thinking of a cake recipe from my mom's sister and an oven-fried chicken recipe from my grandma. The problem, though, is that they really didn't use many recipes. They cooked every day, of course, several times a day, and I'm sure they had family favorites, but not many of those recipes were written down. That's why it's a little funny that I have all these boxes, recipe boxes from my mom that are overflowing with recipes. Because when I was growing up, it seems like we had this same handful of dishes all the time. Pinto beans and cornbread, pork chops and fried potatoes, hamburgers and french fries, meatloaf and mashed potatoes. I'm seeing a definite meat and potatoes pattern there. But none of those everyday dishes required a recipe. And honestly, very few dinners that I make on a regular basis need a recipe either. Spaghetti sauce, stir fries, soups, and stews. In my own kitchen, those are thrown together a lot like my mom's go-to dishes were, I suppose, cooked from memory or until they were done. I tried not long ago to recreate a cornmeal gravy that my mom would make, and in doing that, I realized that she was probably making it to make a meal a little more hearty, you know, to stretch simple ingredients a little further. And that's something to keep in mind when thinking about heirloom recipes, that they were often made with plain ingredients, maybe stretched to feed a few more people, and maybe they aren't as vibrant or flavorful as we'd expect today. I know that the green beans my mom made would be considered cooked to death by today's standards. There were no crisp, tender, bright green vegetables on my mom's table. Those green beans had simmered half the afternoon with potatoes and bacon grease, and their dark green color was nothing like the way I make my green beans today. But maybe this summer I'll make some green beans the way my mom would make them. Maybe I'll make a mess of green beans with some new potatoes and add a little bacon grease and plenty of salt. And maybe I'll write down the directions so that my kids, and who knows, maybe one day their kids, will be able to taste green beans again the way my mom would have made them. And then we'll have an heirloom recipe of our own for a simple dish that will take us back to my mom's kitchen. Heirloom Recipe Contest at the Indiana State Fair is one of my favorite contests to judge, and we got all sorts of dishes this year, from cakes and pies to sausage and sauerkraut. The contest requires a written history of the recipe, along with a prepared dish, and the backstory is 50% of the score. The taste of the dish itself is 40%, and the appearance is 10%, so it isn't a good looks contest. Homey, much-loved family favorites are what wins in this one. The Heirloom Recipe Contest is sponsored by the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance, which sponsors competitions at other Midwestern state fairs as well. I talked with Kathy Lambrecht, president of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance, after the judging, and she tells us how the whole contest came about.
The contest started in 2009, largely because I had an experience in being a contestant at the Illinois State Fair. And because I was one of the few people that participated in the contest who came from Chicago, they thought I had all of these connections that could help them find other contests. And I did help them find other contests, but I knew that there was a hunger to find contests for these fairs. Because, I mean, there's a lot of traditional ones, like for ball and, you know, gold medal flower, but, you know, something like us and our heirloom family recipe was a little bit of an outlier. Something new and fresh.
So what was the reaction when you first launched the contest? And did it start at the Illinois State Fair?
It started at the Illinois State Fair largely because I had connections there. And it was well enough received that we decided to do it again. And in fact, when I contacted the Indiana State Fair, they had been reading the premium book from the Illinois State Fair, and they were about to have a duplicate contest of similar rules. And I said, well, then you'll be happy to work with us instead. He said, sure, because you got the money. Because the prize money at county state fairs, when you just do the regular contest, is somewhat modest. And so $150 for first prize is good money.
It is. I mean, that's a significant prize, right?
It's significant. However, when big companies really get involved, at the Iowa State Fair a few years ago, Tones, who makes various flavorings, vanilla and stuff, they were from apparently Des Moines, Iowa. It was a significant anniversary. They had Martha Stewart come out to judge the contest, and the first prize was $50,000.
Oh, my gosh, now talk about a significant prize.
Huh, yeah, I know. $150 for us, that's a lot of money. For that point of view, it's peanuts. And in fact, there was another contest another year. It was a cinnamon bun. First prize was $5,000. So I think we're doing well, but I know I'm competing with the big boys. I'm not that big.
just so that we kind of have a little background on how the contest works, what are some of the criteria? I know we hear the backstory of a lot of these recipes, and that's a big, significant portion of what we're looking for.
50% is the history. And we want to, it isn't so much that we're looking for the genealogical chart of the family. We're not necessarily looking for the great amusing story that involved somebody transporting that recipe. What we're really interested in is that that recipe had some legs in the family, that it was sort of the heart of the family, that, you know, that if that recipe's lost, a piece of their life and what they remember is slightly gone, it will never be the same. And I want them to get those recipes from their family members before they're really gone. Because sometimes it's irreplaceable.
Well, exactly. And so oftentimes in the story we hear about how somebody didn't know how Aunt so-and-so made the recipe, or they couldn't recreate Grandma's recipe. So these are important parts of a family's history.
In addition, what happens is there's a method, something that they didn't quite tell you about that makes the difference between success and failure. Or it's simply nobody, it was so good, it was just so expected, and nobody thought to ever ask. And now that person's gone, you don't even know how to create it. And the recipes most likely to be lost isn't the dessert recipes. Everybody documents dessert recipes because those are the recipes you don't make every day. It is that we had a recipe here a few years ago where it was Monday, laundry day, and somebody would make a big pile of cornbread and folded all the leftover bits and pieces from the weekend's meals into it and bake it off. And that was your Monday supper. And that's the recipe that nobody thinks to write down.
Exactly. And so those are lost.
And they're not found on Google.
Not those, right?
No.
Another point that I thought was interesting in some of the history was when people would remember that so-and-so wouldn't give them the recipe, wouldn't hand it out. And I just hate it when people won't share the recipes, because that's how you lose them.
Oh, yes. And it's something that people tend... There's only exactly one recipe I make that I don't give out because the person who gave it to me wouldn't let me give it out. But it's totally easy peasy to figure out. It's a Chex Mix. But it's a Chex Mix with macadamia nuts and roasted pecans and a few other little treasures like that, which you can look at and figure out what they did. So that one, I just tell people, look at it, you'll figure it out. Believe me. But it's high-handed. It's almost like, like my friend whose relatives won't give her the recipe because she might make money with it. And all she wants is to recreate something she remembered from her grandma's kitchen. I think it's a crime. It's not a crime against humanity, but it's a crime against your family. You know? And people do take recipes to their grave. You know? And it's not found in their little notebooks. But we did have one person in the Springfield, Illinois area whose family has a small batch candy business that they do out of a barn, out of a building on their farm. And they had a fire. And the original manuscript of recipes was burned in the fire. Some of them had been recorded. Some of them hadn't. So, and they were very upset. One of them was for this peanut brittle. So she goes to a auction. And there was a box of cookbooks. And she bid the price. And then she learned after she was the winning bid that it wasn't for the box of books, it was for each book in the box. So she just impulsively grabbed one of the books. Later on in another auction, she did win the additional box, the rest of it. But at that point, she just impulsively, she opened it up, started looking through it. It was a manuscript cookbook. It was the kind that brides are given when they get married. And this was like around 1910 or whatever. And each person would write in their handwriting the recipe. Her grandmother's peanut butter brittle recipe was in that book.
Oh my goodness, how
lucky is
that? I know,
doesn't it make you feel the chills? And here they thought it was lost forever, and there it is. in her handwriting.
Even better.
Even better. And she paid for it fair and square at an auction. It's now hers. Can you imagine?
I just love those stories. You know, there's just something about family recipes and saving them and making them and thinking of your family, you know, that seems, you know, to bring it all to life a little bit.
A friend of mine she had one of those large yellow clay bowls for making bread dough and such that she got from her grandmother. It fell and broke into many pieces. She had seen bowls like it online, but didn't want to pay. It was too much money. And I remembered seeing it, and I realized I had one of those bowls. So I gave it to her, because I have, you know, I knew it meant more to her than it meant to me. She now tells me when she makes things in that particular bowl, she thinks of her grandmother, and she thinks of me. And I, you know, really was doing it because I knew she wanted it, you know.
Well, see, that's the thing, you know, the things related to food mean something to people. You know, there's really a real meaning attached to that.
Yeah, the human connection that isn't felt when you just, you know, share how to, I don't know. There's many other things, but there's a community spirit to food. It's an act of giving and an act of receiving.
We've been talking with Kathy Lambrecht of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance. You can check the website, greatermidwestfoodways.org. For more information, as well as for winning recipes. You're listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio, and today we are focusing on the Family Heirloom Recipe Contest at the Indiana State Fair. It's sponsored by the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance, and I love getting to judge this contest, which requires entrants to write out the story behind the recipe. Those stories are an important part of the judging, and this year's winner, a date pudding recipe from Fisher's resident Ray Graham, had a great story. In fact, he showed judges several versions of the recipe as it was made by different family members. I talked with Ray after the judging about the winning date pudding recipe and his memories of the family favorite.
Our family did not talk a lot about recipes. I have inherited basically by a lot of my aunts and my mom's and my grandmother's. And I started entering the State Fair Culinary in 2010. I have congestive heart failure, so I went from working a lot to not working. And so I've always cooked, but I've never baked. So in 2010, I started to bake. But I have always made our meals. 36 years, we've been married. My wife does not cook, so I do basically the cooking. But I do, so Christmases, I've made these dishes. But in 2010, I started doing a lot of other baking. I have won Spam in 2015. I won Bohannon Cookies last year. I've come in second in a lot of the things. So I've never entered the heirloom or had never entered Little Red Door because I really never knew much about my family history to enter the heirloom. But going through recipes, I saw this of my grandmother's, and I knew there was history behind it.
Because 50% of the heirloom recipe contest is the story, sort of the backstory, the history of the recipe. And you had several versions of your winning date pudding recipe. So tell me about those versions.
Well, I basically have used my mom's in the past because, again, none of them were complete recipes. You had to kind of guess at what you did next. I mean, it was things like there were, you know, I think it was a cup of dates chopped, and then there was a cup and a half of boiling water. You know, it didn't say to mix those, but you had to make the assumption that you did. And then when you put the flour, your wet ingredients, you had to make the assumption again that you must put that water that the dates were in into the flour mixture to make it wet. So again, a lot of things were never complete, but this recipe was interesting because my grandmother started it at a very low oven temperature, 275, and then immediately my aunts, my brother's sisters, automatically made versions of cooking it at 350, changing the times, and those were things that were noted into it, but then some added, instead of brown sugar, added granular sugar is into the sauce. So again, always minor adjustments, not a lot of major, but never complete stories on what to do. And so, you know, as of this one, and like I said, on one of the recipes it talked about pouring the sauce over the dough. Dough mean, to me, means uncooked, but I don't know. We've never done that, but I may try that sometime just to see.
Yeah, do you remember the relatives that you have their, some of their recipes from? You had an aunt's recipe, right?
Just this recipe, I know when we traveled from Christmas, at Christmas we went to different, every third year it changed a rotation to house, but we'd always have this as our Christmas dessert, and it always was the same, no matter whose you had. And
so it did taste the same in your memory, right?
In my memory, it tasted the same. It was always a sweet date. You know, to me it was a cake, not a pudding. When I first wanted to start making it myself, my wife thought of it as a pudding, and she didn't really want me to make it. You know, I never associated pudding as pudding with it. I always, that was the name of it. And so we've made it every year. And the sauce, I think, is to me, I love the sauce. And it's just brown sugar, water, and vanilla and butter. So
it was an excellent sauce. It really added to the cake.
Well, see, and then but I've made it to my grandmother's recipe, which is just brown sugar, where my aunts did a granulated and brown sugar combination. And I don't know that there really was much of a difference. This, when you boil this, I always fear that it's kind of burning and has that burning smell initially, but it isn't. So, I mean, I was this morning when I was making that stuff, I thought, oh, it's burning, but it's not. You know, you need to keep looking at the pans. No, it is the sauce, and actually I use that same sauce on apple dumplings.
Now, tell me a little bit of details about the recipe itself. So what's involved in the date pudding?
The date pudding is, I guess, originally they used to shell their dates and then cut them up. Today you can actually buy shelled and seedless pitted dates, so it's much easier. And you just, it's about a cup and a half. I pack it tight, so it's probably truly loose, a cup and a half. It has 2 3/4 cups flour. It has a little soda, 2 teaspoons, 2 tablespoons soda, and 1 tablespoon baking powder. The cup and a half boiling water over the dates, and then I put the butter in with that. I think it's 1 tablespoon of butter, which melts into it. 1 teaspoon of vanilla, which incorporates into that. I pour my nuts, which I think is about a cup of ground nuts, pecans. I pour that into the water themselves to get them moist. So when it's baked, I don't like crunchy nuts in baked goods. So I let that sit a while, and then I've incorporated my flour and my baking soda, my soda, and I don't use salt, which is not in, even though my grandmother said a pinch dash of salt, because of my heart, I don't use salt. But I did, this butter itself was salted, where most would be unsalted. And then I dump that dates and pecans and the water into the wet, stir it up, and then it does look like a pudding. I use my mom's aluminum pan, and I pour that in there. I put the lid over it, and I bake it for 45 minutes to an hour, just till the toothpicks dry.
And that's all, right?
That's it. And then you boil water, pour over the brown sugar, a little butter again, a little vanilla, and that's the sauce.
And do you still have it at Christmas time?
Yes. Yes, we do.
Recipes like this, what value do they have, you know, for a family? I mean, it seems like all the stories that we heard at the contest today, you know, it seems like they really mean a lot to people. Do you feel like that?
Well, I never associated this as a tradition until this contest and reading the criteria behind the contest. And then going back and looking at the histories of these, that's really the first time that I felt there was a tradition that's been handed down.
Even though you had it every year growing up?
We enjoyed it. We liked it. You know, I didn't realize it started back in as my dad and my aunts grew up, that was their dinner or their Christmas.
So they had it too, your dad, when he was growing up.
So, I mean, that's from my grandmother and the Aunt Ida that We don't seem to know. I'm not sure where it might have even actually in the picture that was in the scrapbook, it showed my grandmother's mother in there. And now we don't know. Did it start with her? And as the kids saw, we don't know everyone's gone. I can't find out where actually it started, but I do know it started with my grandmother.
See, that's why we have to find out about these recipes while we're happy and enjoying them, so that we can, get the details, get the backstory, write those recipes down.
But then, again, it's growing up, we weren't allowed in the kitchen. So, that access to a lot of that didn't exist. I wanted to be a chef growing up, I grew up with Graham Kerr and Julia Childs. Well, most people don't know who Graham Kerr is. He was a Scottish, and it was more of a... but those were the only cooking shows on TV. And I wanted to be a chef, but because men didn't do that then, in my age group, I really wasn't allowed to pursue that. So I didn't. I went to school for something else, but I've cooked all of my life.
Well, and so it's so fun for me to read the stories and to talk to the people and to taste the recipes, because it really does bring these family histories to life.
We only have one other recipe that I could do this with, and that's from my mom's side of the family. This was my dad's side, so my mom's side, and that was apple dumplings or apple pandowdy. Everything else, I don't really have histories that can go back to grandmothers or great-grandmothers. So,
well, it's so wonderful to try these, and thanks for sharing your family recipes.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Ray Graham, winner of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance Family Heirloom Recipe Contest. We'll be back with more on the contest here on WFYI and WFYI.org. I often get to help judge the Family Heirloom Recipe Contest at the Indiana State Fair, along with Kathy Lambrecht and Peter Engler of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance, which sponsors the contest. This year, though, we had a guest judge, Danville native and retired home ec teacher Marty Turner, who's now living at Prairie Lakes Assisted Living Facility in Noblesville. It was a bucket list wish of hers to judge a recipe contest, and with the help of her assisted living facility, the State Fair, and the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance, we made that happen. I talked with Marty about teaching home ec back in the 60s and 70s, and what has changed, and what stayed the same.
I graduated from Purdue, and I have my BS from there. I have my MS from Butler, and I taught school in Plainfield for 9 years. I started out in New Winchester, which is now a playground. It was consolidated. I did adult education in Florida for another 10 years.
Well, when was that? When did you teach?
I taught from 1968 to 77.
What kind of changes did you see at that time? A lot was going on in popular culture, and a lot of roles changing, and women's lib, and that sort of stuff.
I don't think there's as much change then as there is now. The kids are a lot different. They were wearing short skirts.
Oh, sure, this was the mini skirt era, right?
Yeah, I told them their skirts looked like wide belts. And I was able to do a rather relaxed class. I had, it was all girls at that time, and I had 130 of them about a day.
Oh my goodness, that's a lot of kids to teach.
I taught six classes a day, and most of them had almost 24 in them.
Now, what sort of things were they learning about then?
In seventh grade, we did babysitting and foods, and mostly foods. They liked that best. We did a little bit about child care and development, and making their bed when they get up and go to school in the morning.
What sorts of foods were they learning about?
We did. They learned to do biscuits and creamed foods and just basics, really. How to measure. And even learning to use measuring cups, because some of them absolutely did not know how.
Now, we hear a lot today about how kids don't know how to cook, but as you know, perhaps it's something that hasn't been passed on to them, but that seemed to be like maybe that was a common problem then, too.
Well, we have a lot of mothers who work, and they don't have the time to spend with their kids and teach them, and it's kind of a shame we don't have home ec now like they used to, because our kids really need it.
Well, everyone should know how to cook and take care of themselves, right?
Yes, yes, they know how. They need to learn how to prepare for the future. And a lot of don't.
What sorts of problems were facing the kids back in the 60s and 70s?
That was kind of the hippie generation. And well, as teenagers, or, well, 7th, 8th, and 9th is what I taught. And they're learning to be adults, and they want to be adults a lot faster than they're able to. And they're trying to sprout their wings, and they're getting all kinds of static from their parents, I'm sure.
Some things don't change, right?
No, they never change. My own kids got away with murder because they looked so good to me when I got home.
Now, tell me a little bit about judging the contest today. What did you think about getting to judge the heirloom recipe contest?
I thought it was really well done. I enjoyed it. It was different from what I expected, and it went a lot faster. And this is the first time I've ever judged a contest that I had contestants even in the room.
I know. So they're sitting right in front of us as we judge. So that's a little nerve-wracking, isn't it?
It is. I found myself not paying any attention to them, which was probably a good thing. I didn't see the frowns and scowls as I wrote something down.
That's a very good point, because, you know, a lot of times when you're judging something, you know, you're completely separate. But for this particular event, we were sitting up in front of everybody, and they were watching us judge and listening to the stories, because part of this contest included history.
Yes.
About the recipes. What'd you think about that?
I love that part of it. And the history of the recipes and of the people who turned in the recipes was something that was quite interesting. And I could relate to a lot of them because I'm old enough.
We've been talking with retired home ec teacher Marty Turner, who helped judge this year's Family Heirloom Recipe Contest at the Indiana State Fair. Stay with us for more on the contest here on WFYI and WFYI.org. What is Midwestern food, and what are Midwestern food trends? Well, Kathy Lambrecht spots these trends through her work with the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance. The group sponsors the Family Heirloom Recipe Contest at the Indiana State Fair and other Midwestern state fairs, but it also serves as a food information resource. Kathy explains what the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance is all about.
It was sort of founded in a glib little comment in a conversation, because somebody was offering us some money to do a symposium on anything we wanted to do. And I had just come back from a Southern Foodways event, and I really liked the spirit of that. And I said, maybe we could do something with the Midwest. And that is what started this organization.
Well, now, what were you doing at the time?
At the time, I'm also with Culinary Historians of Chicago, and we had done, several years before, a small symposium highlighting entries in the Oxford Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink. And this guy who contacted me, Bruce Craig, he was ready to repeat that whole process all over again. And I'm like, no, no, I don't like to do the same thing twice. Let's come up with something a little more original. And that's when I brought up the Midwest. And our first symposium was on sausages that you put in a bun and you can walk down the street and eat. So we're talking about hot dogs and bratwursts and things of that nature that, you know, we all enjoy.
So how did that first thing go? What did you find out about hot dogs and sausages?
Well, it didn't hurt that Bruce Craig has written a number of books about hot dogs. So that was totally up his alley. But there were other people. For instance, we had somebody whose expertise was on the Coney dog. We had another person, Peter Engler, who was one of our judges today. One of his areas of interest is something called the mother-in-law, and it's a tamale put in a hot dog bun with, and it can be Chicago-style hot dog fixings. It can also just as well be chili and onions. And we had somebody with a German background talking about bratwurst from Milwaukee. So we had, you know, kind of a, we also had people from University of Iowa or Iowa State, I don't remember which one, but their whole thing was teaching the industry how to make sausage. And he said, the greatest secret when it comes to sausage making is the seasoning blend that go into it. He said, it isn't the pork and the beef, that stuff's all well known. It's that seasoning blend.
So what was the reaction to your first event? Obviously, it must have been popular. Did you continue?
It was very popular, and we have since done an event on beef. You know, it was like from plains to plate. We did a program on the Depression. We did a program on road food where Michael Stern came and talked about food. We did recently an event in Wisconsin on the Supper Club, and that was supported by SC Johnson. And it was, because they supported it, it was free to the public. We had 300 people show up.
Oh, that's great.
It was overwhelmingly successful, because it was one of those things where, you know, we're used to talking to amongst ourselves, you know, but we don't always have the opportunity to talk to the broader audience.
Now, what does the Alliance do in addition to put on events like that?
Well, We try to be a resource for people, journalists, when they're looking to do a topic on the Midwest, which the recipe contest is very helpful, because somebody might be interested in finding something, and if there's somebody within the contest who's done something or something similar, it's already a beginning of someplace to ask a question. And these people are not always people you get to meet.
Right. So you're a resource, you know, for people that you know, might have questions about Midwest traditions or foods or things
right.
like that.
And we also give people advice on how to archive their collections.
Now, how do you archive? I mean, you're talking like a recipe collection or cookbooks?
I'll tell you, one of the things that came across was there was a woman whose grandmother was a female director at the World's Fair in 1932, and she had a trunk of her materials, and she goes, do you know anybody where I can send it to? Okay, that's a job. And I did find a home for it at the Newberry Library, but then there's a regional archives in Illinois, so I've sent people there with some of their collections, and sometimes, you know, what they have is something that it may not be something a collector wants, but at the same time, if you donate it to a place like the Newberry Library, they have an annual sale of cookbooks, and that helps them preserve and acquire new materials for their collection. So it's a full circle.
So do you have advice for people who are, you know, interested in Midwest foodways or recipe history or that sort of thing?
Well, of course, we certainly want them to come and contact us at greatermidwestfoodways.com or culinaryhistorians.com as well, because that's our sister organization. And we not only do a lot of this kind of advising of people and working with them and putting out events, but we usually record most of our events as podcasts. not everything for different reasons, but almost everything. And so there's a rich library, probably over 100 different programs of varying levels of expertise and interest, which are available just to listen to while you're working.
So have you noticed an increase in interest in, you know, sort of the history of the Midwest, Midwestern foods, and that sort of thing?
Oh, most definitely. But we don't quite have the same identity or regional identity like the South has. Because in the South, they have, like, those overarching recipes, you know, grits and shrimp and things. Whereas in the Midwest, we're populated by many different cultures who are somewhat reserved.
Right.
And so we're truly the patchwork quilt. We're not that, you know, uniform thing. And so people don't always even think of themselves as Midwestern. They may think of themselves as American, but they don't think of themselves as being Midwestern. So sometimes we highlight to people things that they never thought about.
Well, now, what is Midwestern cuisine? Do you have an easy answer?
That is the problem. In fact, I got quite depressed at a Christmas party a few years ago because some guy said to me, you know, there really is no Midwestern cuisine. And I was kind of going to argue it, but, you know, and there's many micro cuisines. You know, like just today, you know, we had those date pudding. And I've seen that also in Ohio. Maybe I saw it in Illinois, but I'm not seeing it everywhere. That cookin' the lady made today is a big deal in South Dakota. But the cookin' I make for my family, the cookin' they make in South Dakota, and the cookin' this lady made are not exactly kissing cousins, but they're not the same. So we have a lot of similarity, but then we have our regional things. You know, like even the supper clubs. Wisconsin doesn't have the exclusivity, but how they interpret it is somewhat exclusive. It's like you wish you had it once you've experienced it. You know, I mean, that's the thing that's cool. You could go to different regions and have a whole different way of looking at things. So in a sense, even though we don't have this unifying food culture like you think is going on in the South, we have a lot of vibrancy that we need to recognize ourselves.
We've been talking with Kathy Lambrecht of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance. Stay with us for more from Kathy here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Drink Indiana Radio, and we've been focusing today on the Family Heirloom Recipe Contest at the Indiana State Fair. That contest is sponsored by the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance, and I talked with President Kathy Lambrecht about Midwestern food, including St. Louis fried ravioli, Northern Indiana pizza, and Nashville hot chicken.
The phrase pitch-in is not used universally. I mean, my little, we call it, what is it?
Potluck.
Potluck, exactly. And so the first time I heard the phrase pitch-in, I had to go, well, what's that? I mean, it makes sense.
I'm sure potlucks, pitch-in, carry-in, suppers, that sort of thing.
You go up to Minnesota and everybody has that brown dish casserole thing going, you know, and it's, and everybody, I mean, like meatloaf. Everybody has the one that they like, and that's the best.
Right. And, you know, my personal background, my folks are from Kentucky, so I have, you know, some of that, you know, Appalachian, you know, kind of things going. So, you know, it's chicken and dumplings, and what are your dumplings compared to my dumplings, that sort of thing, you know, because they're not always the same. Some of them are more noodle-like. You know, one of my colleagues has referred to the chicken and dumpling line, you know, that kind of cuts across southern Indiana.
You got that. There's the pork tenderloin sandwich, which the people in Iowa think it's theirs.
No.
It's theirs. I know. I point these out to things. Or sometimes the way a pizza is cut has a regional distinction.
Square pieces or triangular pieces.
There's another variation you probably haven't seen. And it's one that I've seen in Northwest Indiana, and I've seen in the Quad Cities of Illinois, and maybe it's in other parts of Iowa, but I'm not 100% sure. And that's where you take your round pizza, and you cut it down the middle, and then you make lateral slices. So everybody gets a crust and an innie.
So you have long, you have narrow pieces with a crust.
And then you have, so you cut it down the middle, and now at a 90-degree angle, that slice. And you don't see that everywhere.
You're right. You don't. I don't think I've seen a pizza cut that way.
I have. And it's, but you know what? It's diplomatic. Because there's some people, they only want the innies. And there's some people that only want the crust. And they get stuck with the whole thing. And I think that's fair. Because it's very annoying when the crust people just, you know, suddenly all you have is innies. I don't know how you call it, but
So what kind of Midwestern foods do you think we will see more of? Are there some trends that you can identify?
Well, let's just talk about one that's already been. Is that whole business with the fried ravioli from St. Louis? And it used to be you went to a few restaurants in one little neighborhood in St. Louis, and that was it. It was nowhere else. And suddenly, it's on menus from East Coast to the West Coast and probably in Timbuktu, wherever that happens to be.
So there's things that
just take off. And it's like Peter and I were talking about this at another time. Like, for instance, there's suddenly in Chicago, Nashville hot chicken.
Oh, Nashville hot chicken is a thing.
Right. Peter, and he's probably right. He's probably right. He is right. He said there was an article about it in the New York Times a few years ago, and probably all these chefs on their days off went ahead and gave it a shot and went, hey, that's pretty damn good. And some people, you know, it's never hot enough. So they're a recipe that was, you had to go to Nashville for, and that was a big effort, is suddenly, I mean, there's, I live 25 miles north of Chicago. Two blocks from my house, there's a place now that serves Nashville hot chicken.
I love that. I kind of like that spreading around of the regional dishes.
Right, right. And so, you know, you have that here, like, in the... Okay, so, you know, before I came to the fair today, I went to a Burmese restaurant because we have no Burmese by where I live. So that, for me, was, like, something I wanted to try.
Right, and that's here in central Indiana, which is kind of cool.
It is very cool, and it took me a while to figure out what was going on because our first encounter was... And it was because we were going to the Ohio State Fair, and we did a drive-through of Fort Wayne. Checked out the Coney Dogs, which I know you've visited. I mean, over 100 years old. Can you imagine recently there was an article from somebody out in California, the mother of load of the Coney Dog, and it was from the 1930s.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
And you know, they're just...
They're just kids.
They just can't understand that they didn't invent something. But... We suddenly found there were restaurants and multiple grocery stores catering to the Burmese population. But anyway, it took a few years, and I found out that the immigration and naturalization, purposefully sent people to Fort Wayne, Indiana, because it was relatively economical for them to live, and where they could then learn the social things that they needed to succeed.
See, I think that's great. You know, I like the different immigrant groups that, you know, that come to an area, and then they just add to what we already have going.
We have seen now Burmese populations now in Iowa. We saw two Burmese shops in Des Moines. I mean, Peter was had a lot to do with that research. But in Huron, South Dakota, where their state fair is, there's a turkey processing plant. And they were brought in originally to help with the turkey processing. And now over 30 businesses in Huron, South Dakota employ at least one Burmese.
So what else can we expect to see with Midwest cuisines? Anything you would like people to discover?
You know, I think lutefisk needs to be revisited.
Oh, my goodness. Now, I went to a lutefisk dinner just last year. It was at a local Lutheran church, of course.
Yes.
The Sons of Norway.
Okay. I made lutefisk from scratch a few years ago because, it was too expensive to go buy some, but I could go make it. And then I served portions at a program. My theory now on the problem with lutefisk is it's overcooked. you know, take a look at the Canadian process for cooking fish. It's 1 inch, 10 minutes. And here you've got slices that they're boiling for 50 minutes, an hour and a half. What's that? And so here's what happened. I cooked it a little longer than I really wanted to, but not as long as it normally is. And I had somebody come up to me, this is not right, that doesn't have the right taste. So I took a piece, put it in the microwave, beat it all up, handed it to him. He says, it's like rubber bands, but the taste is right. So I'm convinced it's overcooked. And that's why, because really what it is, it's a version of fast food. Because once you've, you know, you take the cod, you soak it for a number of days, changing the water, then you put it into the lye for a number of days, then you put it back in water, multiple changes to get, here was the test. The test was that you, if you did it right, when you cook it, does it suds? Because if the fat in the fish in the lye made soap, then you overprocessed it. That was the test. So I was nervous when I made it for this group. But later on, you freeze it, and you can quickly cook it. Whereas when you have salted fish, you have to go through a process. So I think it's fast food. You just have to do, it's fast food the Swedish way.
We've been talking with Kathy Lambrecht of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance. For more information on the organization and its contests, go to greatermidwestfoodways.org. Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio and WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to our family recipe focused show today. And thanks also to our guests, Kathy Lambrecht of the Greater Midwest Foodways Alliance, Fisher's resident Ray Graham, winner of the Family Heirloom Recipe Contest at the Indiana State Fair, and retired home ec teacher Marty Turner, who helped judge this year's contest. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio. Eat Drink Indy Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy.